Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Parthia, the forgotten ancient superpower, right after this. When people call the law school, they ask, oftentimes, how they can learn more about the topics that I speak on over the air. Well, keep in mind that most of the topics that you hear on the radio, I teach in detail in one of my classes here at the law school. For example, when you hear me talking about the common law, it was Alfred the Great who codified the common law in 872 A.D., and he codified it into 49 principles or statutes, of which 22 were incorporated into our federal Constitution and Bill of Rights. Now, the common law was taken from the Mosaic law given to Moses at Mount Sinai and recorded in Exodus 19, verse 16 through Exodus 24, verse 8. And it includes negligence, insurance, and taxes, such as income, property, and Social Security taxes. Now, these IRS tax laws are a counterfeit of our tithing laws of Scripture, and they work a theft on everyone who participates in them. Now, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob gave us a better way of life than income tax and Social Security, and that's the basis of my tax and status school. It's true, we owe the income tax and Social Security taxes because we've contracted into them. What about contracting out of them? Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can order a copy for yourself. The number is 417-273-4967. Or you can go online to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email machine, or send me a message on the email machine to order that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Now, we've been talking about Stephen Cullen's book, Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower. You probably have never heard the name Parthia. I never had, till I read Cullen's book, and I was really dumbfounded. I've been through the public education system, and so I've been dumbed down. But I'm recovering. I'm 65, and I'm still recovering from my public school education. If you're in that same boat, then listen up. Here's a story that I think you'll be interested in. Parthia's treatment of captured Romans was unusually magnanimous, especially considering the fact that the Romans were the aggressors. Now, the 10,000 captured Romans were resettled east of the Caspian Sea, given wives, and later even served as Parthian soldiers. This would place the resettled Roman captives in the northern portion of Parthia's empire, roughly the modern nation of Turkmenistan. Indeed, the modern Sapramurat Turkmenbashi National Museum of Turkmenistan in Ashgabat. Now, that's a mouthful. Turkmenistan contains an exhibit of Parthian artifacts excavated from the ancient Parthian city of Nisa, N-I-S-A. The exhibit includes a clay statue of a head of a Parthian warrior with obvious Caucasian European, that is, for instance, Semitic features, as well as the armored helmet about which Plutarch and other historians wrote. Rawlinson comments that at Carrhae, the Parthians acquired by their use of the bow a fame like English archers at Crecy and Agincourt. They forced the arrogant Romans to allow that there was at least one other nation in the world which could meet them on equal terms. They henceforth obtained recognition from the Greco-Roman writers as the second power in the world, the admitted rival of the Roman Empire. Now, although the Greco-Roman writers acknowledged that Parthia was a second superpower which equaled Rome, modern history accounts generally omit that important fact. However, Richard Fry's Heritage of Persia does note that after the Battle of Carrhae, the world was divided between Rome and Parthia according to Greek and Latin authors. The two empires divided the known world into the Parthian and Roman spheres of influence, much like the modern world was divided during the Cold War into the American and Russian spheres of influence. Crassus was given a final, grisly insult by the Parthians. Serenus sent the head and the hand of Crassus to Armenia, where the Parthian king was visiting. Armenia had made peace with the Parthian king. The Parthians, mindful of Crassus' avarice, poured molten gold into the mouth of Crassus' decapitated head. This was done to impress upon the Armenian rulers that utter superiority of the Parthians over the Romans. Parthian rulers were well-educated and multilingual. When Crassus' body parts arrived, the Parthian and Armenian kings were enjoying a Greek theatrical performance, and the actors even contemptuously utilized Crassus' head as a prop in the play. The First Parthian-Roman War was an absolute Parthian victory in terms of both tactics and technology. Rome was simply no match for Parthia. Rome would not underestimate Parthia again, but it is possible that Rome never really grasped the true size and power of the Parthian Empire. Maps of the Parthian Empire do not show its borders extending into India, but Parthia's eastern border is a matter of some conjecture. Now, the Encyclopedia Britannica records that the kings with Parthian names, for example, Gondophares, reigned in the Punjab region of India, and that the great commercial town of Minagar in the Indus Delta was under Parthian kings. Perhaps fearing that the great victory of Serenus would make him a rival, Orodes, the Parthian king, had his loyal commander killed. This illustrates a paradox in Parthian history. Although Parthian rule over its subjects was generally wise and temperate, the Parthian royalty had a history of murderous internecine struggles, and since any male Arsacid could be king, there was always a host of pretenders and schemers with royal ambitions, causing many Arsacids to kill each other to eliminate their rivals. Now, this violent family history fulfilled a biblical prophecy in 2 Samuel 12, verse 10, that the sword, violent deaths, would never depart from David's progeny because of David's murder of his own loyal military commander, Uriah. Parthia soon retaliated for Rome's invasion by crossing the Euphrates River and attacking Rome's eastern provinces. Pacorus, the son of Parthian emperor Orodes, led a large Parthian army. King Orodes sent an experienced military commander named Osacus to help Pacorus in his campaign. Note that the name of the Parthian commander, Osacus, is based on the Hebrew name Isaac, after whom all of the Scythian Saki were named. This invasion was short-lived, and Parthia withdrew its forces to its own side of the Euphrates River in 50 BC. 10 years later, in 40 BC, the Parthians attacked Rome in considerable power. The Roman Empire buckled under the force of the attack. The Parthians conquered Syria, Judea, and even pushed the Romans out of Asia Minor. Emboldened by Parthian successes, the Jews asserted their independence from Rome, and a Jewish prince, Antigonus, ruled Palestine as a Parthian satrap until 37 BC. Rawlinson wrote the following about Parthia's conquest of Rome's Asia province. The Parthians were in possession of Asia to the shores of the Hellespont, and it may be said that for a full year Western Asia switched masters. The rule and authority of Rome disappeared, and the Parthians were recognized as the dominant power. This marked the greatest size of the Parthian Empire. Parthian rule extended from the Indus River in the east to the shores of the Aegean Sea in the west, and their armies had defeated the Romans with relative ease. At this point in history, all of the nations within the Roman and Parthian empires and spheres of influence recognized and realized that the Parthians had the Roman Empire on the run. McClintock and Strong's Cyclopedia notes the following about the Parthians. It says, from the time of Crassus to that of Trajan, they were an enemy whom Rome especially dreaded. Up to this point, Parthia had little reason to respect either Rome's words or its military abilities. However, at this point of supreme Parthian accomplishment against Rome, the Parthians would now learn that the Roman Empire could be a powerful foe after all. Parthia had overextended itself, and the Romans had been crippled by civil wars and leadership struggles. That prevented Rome from mounting an effective defense of its eastern provinces. However, at this juncture, it was critical that the Romans recover their eastern provinces from the Parthians. If they did not do so, not only would Roman honor and pride be permanently damaged, but such apparent Roman weakness could embolden other Roman provinces to revolt in an effort to break free of Roman rule. So the Romans counterattacked with great determination, recovered their lost territories, and reestablished the Euphrates River as the border between these two empires. Rawlinson records that the short Parthian rule of the conquered Roman provinces was mild and just. Many of the natives preferred Parthian to Roman rule, and indeed Antigonus, the Parthian-sponsored ruler of Judea, resisted King Herod, his Roman-sponsored replacement, for quite a time. In the previous book in the series, it was shown that when the Scythian Israelites conquered Judea around 620 BC, it resulted in the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel again briefly ruling Palestine. They stayed only a few years and left voluntarily. When the Parthians controlled Palestine from 40 to 37 BC, it was a second instance when the 10 tribes of Israel again dominated their ancestral homeland. Again, it lasted only a few years. During the 3 years of Parthian rule over Palestine, there would have been a large exchange of information between the Jews and the Parthians. The Jews would have become aware, if they did not already know, that the Parthians were descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel, their brother tribes. Under Parthians' rule, the Jews would have enjoyed unhindered contacts with the large Jewish communities living in the Parthian Empire. Now, Josephus, a prominent Jewish historian, likely drew on this knowledge when he later designated the Parthian Empire, the land beyond the Euphrates, as the region inhabited by the numerous descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. The next Parthian king, Phraates IV, killed his brothers. His father, King Orodes, who had abdicated in his son's favor, and even some of the Parthian nobility, again fulfilled the curse of 2 Samuel 12:10 about the sword abiding among David's progeny. At this time of internal chaos, the Romans again invaded Parthia in a new war of imperial aggression. This time, Rome's aggression was led by Mark Antony, the famous consort of Cleopatra, the Queen of Egypt. Antony invaded Parthia in 37 BC with 16 legions and an army of 113,000 men. The Romans now had more respect for Parthian power, and Antony invaded Parthia with an army almost three times the size of Crassus' ill-fated expedition. Rome keenly felt dishonored that the standards of Crassus' seven legions had been captured by the Parthians at the Battle of Carrhae, and Antony was to try to recover them as one objective of the war. But as events unfolded, Antony was fortunate to get out of Parthia with his own life and standards intact. He didn't get Crassus' standards back. Antony's army besieged a Parthian provincial capital in Media, modern northwest Iran, but he could not subdue it. Parthia's own army arrived and wiped out Antony's supply columns, killing 10,000 Romans. With winter imminent, Antony had to admit defeat and led his beaten and retreating army ignominiously through Armenia, fighting the terrain, the weather, hunger, and Parthians the whole way. Considering the hardships faced, Mark Antony did well to salvage 60 to 70,000 Roman soldiers from his disastrous campaign, as he almost lost his whole army and his own life. Now Mark Antony and the retreating Romans acted cruelly toward the Armenians, creating a lasting impression among the Armenians that Parthian rule was preferable to Roman rule. Once again, a Roman invasion of Parthia turned into a complete Parthian victory. A peaceful period of détente then occurred between Parthia and Rome, which lasted about a century. From 36 BC to 58 AD, Parthia and Rome had learned that they were equal superpowers in the ancient world, with the Euphrates River serving as a mutually accepted border. While Parthia had crushed two Roman attempts to invade the Parthian Empire, Rome had successfully pushed Parthian armies back across the Euphrates after Parthia occupied Rome's eastern provinces for about 3 years. Phraates IV, the emperor of Parthia, who had killed his brothers and father after ascending to the throne, lived to reap what he had sown. After a 35-year reign, he was assassinated by his wife and son in 2 BC. And it's quite significant that a delegation of Parthia's nobility, the wise men, or the magi of Matthew 2, verses 1 through 12, had come to worship the Christ child at about the same time, as this confirms that God was very personally involved with the Parthian leadership and had even revealed Jesus Christ's divinity to them. The Magi, or Magi, came from Parthia to visit the Christ child. They knew who he was and they knew what his destiny was to become. In 1 AD, when another Roman invasion seemed imminent, Parthia and Rome avoided hostilities by way of a summit conference. Roman writers recorded that the respective armies of the Roman and Parthian empires lined up on each side of the Euphrates River while the negotiators met on neutral territory, an island in the middle of the river. Parthia's emperor Pheraetes met with Caius Caesar, the grandson of Augustus Caesar, as they negotiated an agreement. While war was averted, the Romans seemed to have won a slight victory at the conference table. While the Romans agreed to withdraw their armies from Parthia's borders, the Parthians agreed to accept Armenia as being within Rome's sphere of influence. This Parthian-Roman summit conference prolonged the period of peace between the two great superpowers, and it was during this time that Jesus Christ was born, conducted his ministry, and was crucified. Christ himself was personally involved in the geopolitics of Parthian-Roman relations, as we shall document. Indeed, if this period of peaceful relations had not occurred, some critical events in Jesus' life could never have occurred. The internecine conflicts of the Arsacid family members became so great that Parthia even sent members of its royal family to Rome during this period of détente. They were safer there than in Parthia due to the assassinations among the Arsacid family in Parthia. However, when Parthian royalty were summoned to Parthia from Rome, they alienated the Parthians with their foreign ways, and several times the Scythians became arbiters of who should be the Parthian king by their military intervention in behalf of specific Arsacid princes. Given the turmoil within the royal house of the Arsacids, or the Parthians, it is remarkable that this one dynasty remained or maintained its rule over Parthia throughout its existence. This prophecy of Jeremiah 33, verse 17, that David's descendants would continually rule over the 10 tribes of Israel, was kept unbroken during Parthia's existence, and while many Parthian monarchs were corrupt in their personal lives, a few of them were very religiously devout. One Parthian provincial king adopted Judaism and had his remains buried near Jerusalem. The presence of Parthian pilgrims at a Pentecost Feast of Weeks celebration in Jerusalem, recorded in Acts 2 verse 9, confirms that some Parthians served the God of Israel. The events of Acts 2 occurred during this period of détente, a period between Rome and Parthia when Parthians were free to travel to Jerusalem and participate in the biblical holy days of God. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto, which is a foreign and alien ideology. Traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. But these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. And we covet our neighbor's property, and then we're taught to call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve notes, and then we're taught to practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods called government. And we don't get away with our crimes either. We're now paying up to 74% of everything we create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged homes owned by the savings and loan companies. We drive cars owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance. The average family of four in America has a $70,000 consumer debt, and we as a nation owe a $7 trillion national debt. And we're surety guarantors for another $44 trillion of unfunded government obligations. Our financial institutions are leveraged out to $60 trillion worldwide, and our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme. And we're now living from paycheck to paycheck, and we're taught to call all of this prosperity. Well, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way. Now, to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call for my free 4-hour compact disc package? It's educational, entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, a book written by Stephen M. Collins, published by BibleBlessings.net. If you want to go to their website, it's www.BibleBlessings.net. Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, the zip code 48068. Well, while Parthian Roman affairs were calm, Parthia fought and lost a war in the region of Armenia to an alliance of Iberians and Scythians headed by King Phasismanes of Iberia. This war of 35-36 AD pitted two alliances of the tribes of Israel against each other. The previous book in this series documented that the Israelites who escaped the Assyrians by fleeing to the Black Sea region north of Armenia had established Iberian and Scythian kingdoms. King Phasismanes bore the name of the Judaic line of Phares, and Iberia was named after Eber, the Hebrew patriarch. Parthian king Artabanus lost this war, and he fled to the Scythians living by the Caspian Sea for sanctuary. The Parthian Arsacids were severely reduced in numbers by 51 AD because an extraordinarily cruel emperor, Gotarzes, had sought to eliminate all rivals to his throne in the usual way by murdering all of those and those that were close or distant male relatives. He even killed Arsacid children and pregnant women in the royal families. In 51 AD, a remarkable amity occurred between three brothers who were eligible for the Parthian throne. One, Vologasus, that's spelled V-O-L-A-G-A-S-I-S. Vologasus I became the Parthian emperor. A second, Pacorus, P-A-C-O-R-U-S, became vassal king of Media. And the third, Tiridates, T-I-R-I-D-A-T-E-S, was appointed king of Armenia. This latter choice caused several political problems because Armenia, with a Parthian name, Mithridates, who was also the brother of King Pharos Manes of Iberia already ruled Armenia, so to assert Parthian rule over Armenia would surely result in war. But an external war was likely preferable to the internal civil war which could have occurred within Parthia had not the third royal brother been awarded a prominent province. Now, this Parthian action resulted in a desultory Parthian-Roman conflict over Armenia until 62 AD. I think that's pronounced desultory. When Nero, Rome's emperor, sent a Roman army to fight the Parthians, the Romans were shocked when Parthia launched a winter offensive against them, and the Romans suffered another crushing defeat that left Armenia firmly in Parthian hands. During this time, the Armenians fought to be under Parthian rulership. And, of course, this was understandable since Parthian rule was typically milder than Roman rule. The strange peace settlement occurred in which Parthia kept control of Armenia and Rome won a concession to her imperial vanity at great cost to Rome. The agreement left Tiridates, the brother of the Parthian king, as the undisputed ruler of Armenia. Recognizing Parthia's victory on the battlefield, however, to assuage Rome's pride, Tiridates arrived and agreed to travel to Rome to receive his crown from Nero to preserve a facade that Rome gave rulership to Armenia to Tiridates. Tiridates traveled to Rome escorted by 3,000 Parthian cavalry troops. Rome paid all Parthian travel expenses, and classical writers recorded that it cost the Roman treasury 800,000 sesterces a day for 9 months. This treaty gave the Parthians control over Armenia, and the Romans won the right to reward 3,000 Parthians with an all-expense-paid trip to Rome so that Tiridates could cooperate in Nero's facade. Yet, at any rate, both parties were satisfied. The Parthian-Roman relations were amicable for several decades. This was the only time that thousands of Parthia's famous armored cavalry force actually made it to Rome. However, they were there as Rome's guests. Now, toward the end of the 1st century BC, the Parthians established friendly relations with the Dacians, D-A-C-I-A-N-S, a people living in eastern Europe along the Danube River, who also disliked the Romans. The establishment of Parthian goodwill with the Dacians, called Getek by the Greeks, will become significant in the next book in this series, so it is mentioned at this juncture. In the reign of Mithridates IV, 107 to 113 AD, the Parthians began placing Semitic inscriptions on their coins. Previous coins had simply contained the Seleucid practice of using Hellenistic inscriptions. Now, the switch was consistent with the fact that the Parthians utilized a Semitic alphabet. The Encyclopedia Britannica notes the following regarding Parthia's language. The alphabets in use in Persia, at least from the time of the Arsacid dynasty onward, for example, the time of the Parthian Empire, are based upon the Aramaic. Now, the Parthian use of an alphabet based on Aramaic, a language closely related to Hebrew, further affirms that the Parthians were the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. If the Parthians and the Scythians had originated in northern Asia, their alphabets and language would not have been Semitic. The very fact that the Parthians utilized an eastern Mediterranean alphabet confirms that Parthian origins were in the eastern Mediterranean, the former homeland of the 10 tribes of Israel. Now, George W. Rawlinson translates the legend on the coins of Mithridates IV as Miradat Mulcha. Richard Fry's book, The Heritage of Persia, makes this observation about the Parthian coins. It says, after the Parthian conquest of western Iran, the coins changed to resemble modern or the then modern Parthian prototypes, and the title MLK, king, appears. Now, the Hebrew Aramaic word for king is Melek, the consonants being MLK. Fry lists the Parthian word for king as being the Hebrew Semitic word MLK, and Rawlinson renders the consonants as MLCH. The linguistic evidence further confirms the Hebrew Semitic origin of the Parthians. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, listen, welcome to Tax Freedom Day. That was May 12th. May 12th. You work all of January, February, March, April, and a third of May to pay your income tax here in the United States for the year. That's not all. Then you get to work the rest of May and all of June to pay for your withholding taxes. Now, this income and Social Security tax, these two taxes are two criminal enterprises, and that's because the income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank. Now, the income tax and Social Security also violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Scriptures, including our English common law. Now, there are more than 14 million Americans who are not enrolled in Social Security, and there are more of us opting out every day. Now, you owe it to yourself to at least ask this question: do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? If the answer to that is no, why don't you call or write today for my free general law CD package? Now, to order your free general law CD package, just call me direct and order yours today. The number is 417-273-4967. Or you can go to my website, that's georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing a book, Parthia, The Forgotten Ancient Superpower, and Its Role in Biblical History by Stephen M. Collins. You can get a copy of the book from the publisher. The publisher in this case is Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. All right, the Romans again broke their treaties and war resulted. This was around 114 AD. Rome's Emperor Trajan, by subterfuge, had a nephew of the Parthian monarch killed who had come to him as a diplomat. In noting Trajan's deceitfulness, Rawlinson describes Trajan's actions as disgraceful and base, filled with arrogance and pride. Trajan set out to conquer Asia like a new Alexander the Great. While wintering in Antioch, Syria, Trajan barely escaped with his life when he was almost killed in a destructive earthquake, which was of a violence and duration unexampled in ancient times. Many Romans of the highest rank perished, and besides leveling Antioch, it destroyed nine other cities and Roman provinces in Asia, Asia Minor, and Greece. Was it a portent of things to come? Well, here's what Rawlinson wrote. It seemed as if Providence had determined that the new glories which Rome was gaining by the triumphs of her arms should be obscured by calamities of a kind that no human power had or could ever avert. And the reign of Trajan should go down into posterity as one of gloom, suffering, and disaster. Now, if the earthquakes were a divine warning, Trajan paid no heed. He resumed his invasion of Parthia's western provinces and was almost unopposed as he marched through Mesopotamia. Advancing as far as the Persian Gulf, Trajan then indulged in sheer egomania, viewing himself as another Alexander the Great, taking a pleasure voyage down the Tigris River and regretting that his advanced years prevented him from making India the term of his labors. Now, the Bible states in Proverbs 16, verse 18, that pride goes before destruction, and that a haughty spirit before a fall. Trajan was about to become a living example of the truth of that proverb. Now, the Parthians had not yet fought a serious pitched battle to oppose the invasion of Trajan's Roman army. Either they were caught unprepared by Trajan's campaign, or they had another strategy and another agenda. As Trajan was indulging his ego in the Persian Gulf, the Parthian provinces recently occupied by the Romans rebelled on a massive scale. Now, although the Romans burned Seleucia and other cities, the natives exacted a heavy toll on the Romans and even exterminated an entire Roman army. Now, the Parthians, meanwhile, risked very little, as their former subjects did the fighting to revolt and to remove the hated Romans. History was repeating itself. The ancestors of these same native populations had once fought the Seleucid Greeks in order to return to Parthian rule. Now their descendants were fighting the Romans to return to Parthian rule. Trajan was in a dangerous situation, as his line of retreat was full of hostile nations, and additionally, nature itself became a Parthian ally, and it's recorded that the Romans, quote, suffered from the heat, suffered from swarms of flies, which disputed with them every morsel of their food and every drop of their drink, and finally, from violent hail and thunderstorms. Now, perhaps it was no coincidence. There is a strong likelihood that God periodically involved himself in the affairs of the Parthian Empire. Remember, it was God who conveyed upon the Parthians the birthright benefits of the Abrahamic covenant. God was involved with keeping his Bible promises by placing the descendants of King David on the thrones ruling the tribes of Israel in Parthia. Scythia and Iberia, and even by ensuring that David's own progeny were often slain by the sword by way of intrigues and plots within the royal family. God has prophesied that he would remain involved with the 10 tribes of Israel, and that he would do so after the kingdom of Israel fell and they either fled to or were carried as captives into Asia. We read that in Hosea 1, 4 through 10, which contains a prophecy that God would control the fates of Israel's tribes in such a way that they would be vastly increased in population after they were placed in Asia. Josephus' writings, cited earlier, records that this prophecy had been fulfilled in his lifetime, as will be discussed in considerable detail in the next chapter. God had to be involved personally with the Parthian Magi to bring them to worship the Christ child, whom soon after he was born in Judea. There were worshippers of the God of Israel from many provinces of the Parthian Empire who made pilgrimages to Jerusalem for one of God's holy days, as we see in Acts 2, 9 through 11. There were many devout Jews in Parthia who served the God of Israel as well. Now, at least one Parthian provincial king worshipped Israel's God in the apostolic era, and the Parthians were placing Semitic inscriptions on their coinage. The last face argues that the Parthians were openly and officially identifying with their Semitic Israelite roots, and given all of the facts above, there is every reason to believe that God took as much interest in the national affairs and destiny of the Parthians in that age as he did in the affairs of the ancient kingdoms of Israel and Judah in their age. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto, and these programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. And the income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. This income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. The income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires that we sign contracts with these foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36, and Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. We're then taught to call that income redistribution. You know, the scripture calls it exactly what it is, covetousness and theft in violation of Exodus 20, verses 15 and 17. Now, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention followed that better way. And that's why I contend that you and I ought to learn of and to practice that better way of life. For more information, why don't you call 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free General Law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary. It's a commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and Status is available on compact disc for adult home education, and if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Parthia. Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, written by Stephen M. Collins. Let me give you the name and address one more time. This is a dynamite read. It's a 1 in 100 book. It's the way I rate books. 1 in 20 means you'll read 20 books and you'll find some book that's worth reading. 1 in 100 means there's nothing like it. Charlotte Isserby's book, for instance, on the deliberate dumbing down of America, is one of those books. The Harmony of Science and Scripture by Harry Rimmer is another one. Well, there's a series of books being written. Four of them have been written so far by a fellow by the name of Stephen Collins. He's written four of the six books in a series detailing and outlining with great detail the migrations and the history of the Israelites from the time of Moses to the present time. In fact, in his book, The Ten Tribes of Israel Found identifies the modern nations today of those ten tribes of Israel. And he does it in a very scientific and historical methodology. This book, called Parthia, The Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History, Stephen M. Collins, can be obtained by going to the website www.BibleBlessings.net. That's www.BibleBlessings.net. Or go to Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Royal Oak, Michigan, P.O. Box 1778. The zip code 48068. As I said, it's a dynamite read. It's a 1 in 100 book. I don't think you'll find anything quite like it. There are other books, of course, written about the Bible, Bible history, Bible prophecy. But this book is unique. It's one of six. There are four that have been written so far. Parthia, the Ancient Forgotten Superpower. Collins goes on and he says, therefore it's possible that God himself caused the earthquakes, plagues, and flies and the hail to punish the arrogant Trajan. The Bible records many instances where God has intervened in similar fashion in behalf of the Israelite tribes when they're in a state of reliance upon Him. Also, while God gives humans a lot of rope, the Bible has many accounts of God acting to punish nations and national leaders when they become too vain. Most unusual at this time was the lack of any major Parthian military action against the Romans. In the past, they quickly clashed with invading Romans, generally routing them on the battlefield. Why did they not confront Trajan? Were they internally weakened, or had the Parthians been told by an unnamed prophet of God not to fight because the battle was the Lord's? Now, the Parthians won a bloodless victory by reoccupying their territories as the retreating Romans abandoned them. Trajan died soon after his humiliating defeat, and the new Roman emperor, Hadrian, unilaterally gave back to Parthia all territory taken by Trajan and recalled all Roman forces back on Rome's side of the Euphrates River. Now, that was very uncharacteristic of Rome to yield large amounts of territory under any circumstance, and it was unprecedented for Rome to cede so much territory absent any military threat. Now, since the Parthians had done nothing militarily to warrant such action, it is likely that the polytheistic Romans feared Parthia's god and viewed the many natural disasters visited upon the Romans who invaded Parthia to be divine punishment. Nothing else explains Rome's very unusual behavior in this regard. Stung now by the disasters that struck Trajan from the heavens, Rome avoided Parthian wars for another 50 years. When hostilities did seem imminent at one time, peace ensued after another. Summit conference in 122 AD when the Roman Emperor Hadrian and the Parthian Emperor Chosroes had a face-to-face encounter. The next Parthian emperor, whose name was Vologasus, continued the use of Semitic inscriptions on his coins. This prolonged Parthian use of the Semitic word Melcha, M-A-L-C-H-A, for king is significant, and it merits further comment. In John 18, verse 10, it shows us that Malchus, M-A-L-C-H-U-S, the same root word, was being used as a Hebrew proper name in the first century A.D. The Hebrew word for king is represented by the consonants M-L-K, and the Parthians used the consonants M-L-C-H or M-L-K to designate the Semitic word king on their coins. Now, when you consider that the CH symbol can represent the same phonetic sound as a K, the Hebrew Aramaic origin of this word becomes clear. And Rawlinson noted that Semitic legends are frequent on the coins of the later Parthian kings. And on this specific issue, I again acknowledge the help of the late Dr. Charles Dorothy, a graduate of the Claremont Graduate School, who noted to this author that the Hebrew C-A-P-H may be transliterated as either C-H or K. The prolonged Parthian switch to Semitic inscriptions on their coins is evidence that they were aware of their Semitic origins. This was a watershed event, and it is evidence of a major change in Parthian society. The Apostolic Christian Church had evangelized Parthia during the first century A.D. Eusebius wrote that the Apostle Thomas was sent to the Parthians and that Andrew went to Scythia. In 1 Peter 5, verse 13, records and records that the Apostle Peter was inside the Parthian Empire, the city of Babylon, when he wrote his first epistle. Some mistakenly assume Peter figuratively meant Rome when he wrote Babylon as the city from whence he authored 1 Peter. However, Rome was Gentile, and it was Paul the Apostle sent to the Gentiles. Ephesians 3, verses 8 and 2 Timothy 1, verse 11, it was Paul who went to Rome, not Peter. Peter was a simple fisherman who was not accustomed to using the literary devices of a highly educated Jew like the Apostle Paul. Peter even wrote that Paul's epistles were hard to be understood. He said that in 2 Peter 3, verses 15 and 16. Peter wrote Babylon because he literally meant the city of Babylon. The city of Babylon was located within the Parthian Empire, not the Roman Empire. Matthew 10, verse 6 states that Jesus specifically told his 12 apostles to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, the 10 tribes of Israel. Peter's presence in the Mesopotamian city of Babylon, located in Parthia's empire, confirms that he followed Jesus Christ's instructions. The presence of at least three apostles in Parthia and Scythia confirms that they were obeying Christ's instructions by evangelizing the 10 tribes of Israel located in those regions. Their message surely included the theme, "You Parthians or Scythians are the 10 tribes of Israel, and the Messiah, Jesus, was sent and has sent us unto you." Since some of Parthia's elites, the Magi, had worshipped Jesus Christ before the apostles were even called, they were assured of a warmer reception for their message in Parthia than in any of the Roman domain. And the above reveals that Parthian-Roman events of this period must be understood in the context of what was clearly a significant penetration of the Christian religion into the Parthian Empire, including its ruling classes. The Encyclopedia Britannica states the following regarding this period of Parthia's history. Greek culture practically vanishes and gives place to Aramaic. It is significant that in the future of the kings of Mycenae, M-E-S-E-N-E, stamped their coinage with Aramaic legends. This Aramaic victory was powerfully aided by the ever-increasing progress of Christianity, and mentions Edessa, E-D-E-S-S-A, a city in which the last king of O-S-R-O-E-N-E, Osroni, Abgar the Ninth in 179 to 214 A.D. had been converted to the Christian faith. And according to Harper's Bible Dictionary, Aramaic was a Semitic language closely related to Hebrew. Several passages in the Old Testament are written in official Aramaic. Cited are texts in Ezra, Daniel, Jeremiah, and Genesis. And Jesus probably spoke a dialect of Western Aramaic, and some words in the New Testament come from Aramaic. Now, the prominence of Aramaic in Parthian life during the apostolic and post-apostolic period was concurrent with the spread of Christianity into Parthia from Palestine. Whether the reader wishes to conclude that the Parthians were aided by divine action against the Romans or not, the fact remains that nature itself did wage war against Rome at a time when Christianity had many converts in Parthia, and when Parthia had recognized its Semitic origins. The reign of Vologasus II, Parthia's emperor for 19 years, between 130 and 149 A.D., is characterized as having a general character of tranquility. This tranquility within Parthia's ruling house stands in stark contrast to the murderous internal struggles of the Arsacids during the Christian apostolic period. As Christianity penetrated the Parthian Empire, it would seem that its benign doctrines influenced the conduct of Parthia's rulers as well. Predictably, the Romans eventually reneged on their treaty with Parthia. During Trajan's invasion, the Romans had captured a golden throne of the Parthians in the Roman Empire. Hadrian had promised to return it as part of a peace settlement. Well, after attempts to secure Roman compliance with the treaty failed, Parthia went to war. Under Vologasus III, Parthia again conquered Armenia and restored a native ruler as king of Armenia. A Roman legion crossed the Euphrates and was annihilated by the Parthians. The Parthians then crossed the Euphrates into Roman territory, but their success was short-lived. A Roman army led by Avidius Cassius won a major battle against the Parthians, who retreated to the Parthian side of the Euphrates River. Avidius Cassius then led his army across the Euphrates and reconquered Parthia's western provinces, occupied briefly during Trajan's invasion. Cassius burned Seleucia, having then 400,000 residents, and captured Parthia's western capital. The Romans marched at will through Parthia's western provinces, and the Parthians seemed powerless to resist. Just when the Romans seemed invincible, however, they were driven from Parthia not by a Parthian army, but by a terrible plague. Again, it was nature which waged war against the Romans a second time. Now, it makes you wonder if the arrogant Romans, who knew of Trajan's disasters decades previous to this time, taunted the heavens with words like, "Parthia's God can't protect them from us," or whether such an attitude provoked a divine response as it did in the time of King Hezekiah of ancient Judah that we read of in 2 Kings 18 and 19. Now, the plagues came with a terrible force upon the Romans, and it eventually devastated the entire Roman Empire. This plague was so unprecedented that there was no doubt in the Romans' minds that this plague was supernatural in origin, and the polytheistic Romans attributed the divine plague to spells of the Chaldeans unleashed because of Roman excesses in looting a temple of Apollo. The plague, of a strange and terrible character, was so contagious that Rawlinson refers to the return of this army to Rome as a march of death through the provinces. As it spread the disease throughout the Roman Empire, Rawlinson cites Roman historians as stating, "This pestilence raged with special force throughout Italy and spread as far as the Rhine River and Atlantic Ocean. According to one writer, more than one half of the entire population and almost the whole Roman army was carried off by it." Well, we'll have to take a break right here. I'm going to put a mark in the book. We'll be back next time, tomorrow night, with more on this book called Parthia, The Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History. Remember, you can get a copy from Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. I recommend it highly. You'll never read anything like it. Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Or go to the website www.BibleBlessings.net. It's www.BibleBlessings.net. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD set. It's a CD package. To order yours, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal that says our time is up. I'll have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.